Chapter 6. Madame Anjou's boutique, Chic de Paris, was situated on the ground floor of a huge multi-storied house in the very center of the city, on Theatre Street, behind the Opera House. Entrance into the boutique was gained through a glass door at the top of three steps leading from the street. On either side of the glass door were two windows hung with dusty tulle curtains. Nobody knew the whereabouts of Madame Anjou, and as a consequence, her boutique was being used for purposes quite other than commercial. In the left-hand window, someone had drawn a picture of a colourful lady's hat with the words Chic Parisien written in gold letters, while in the right-hand window there was a huge yellow cardboard poster depicting two crossed Sevastopol cannon similar to those on the epaulettes of artillery officers, with the following words written above. You might not be a hero, but you are obliged to enlist as a volunteer. And underneath the cannon, enrollment of volunteers in the mortar battalion, named after the commanding officer, now taking place. At the entrance to the boutique there was a blackened and partially dismantled motorcycle and sidecar. Every other minute, the entrance door, which was on a spring, banged shut, and each time it opened again, the doorbell rang magnificently. Ring, ring, reminding people of recent and happier times when Madame Anjou was in charge. Alexei Turbin, Mishlaevsky, and Karas got up at practically the same time after their night of drinking with, to their astonishment, completely clear heads. Although it is true they all got up fairly late, around midday. Nikolka and Shervinsky had clearly already left the house. Nikolka had hastily wrapped up a mysterious little red bundle and, muttering to himself, had gone off to join his unit. A few minutes before, Shervinsky had left for army headquarters. Mishlaevsky stood stripped to the waist in Anyuta's cherished little room behind the kitchen with a wash basin and bath hidden by a curtain. He doused his back, neck, and head with icy cold water and shouted out with a shriek of horrified delight.
Hey, that's wonderful!
He yelled so loudly that it could be heard for many yards around. Then he dried himself with a rough towel, dressed, brilliantined and combed his hair, and said to Alexei,
Alyosha, be a good chap and lend me your spurs. I won't have time to go home, and I don't want to turn up without any spurs.
You'll find them in the study, in the desk, right-hand drawer. Mishlaevsky went to the study, where he clattered around for a bit, then came out again, his spurs jingling. Black-eyed Anyuta, who had returned that morning after spending her day off with her aunt, was busy dusting the chairs with a feather duster. Mishlaevsky cleared his throat, gave a sideways glance at the door, and started to adopt a more circuitous route, making a detour towards Anyutochka.
Hello, Anyutochka. I'll tell Yelena Vasilievna,
Anyuta whispered quickly and mechanically, without a second thought, and closed her eyes like an intended victim waiting for someone to stab her.
You silly little...
At that moment, Alexei unexpectedly poked his head round the door. His face was as dark as thunder.
You see that brush, Vitya? Right. It's lovely, isn't it? I would get out of here now if I were you. And you, Anyuta, you need to bear in mind that if he starts talking about marriage, don't believe a word of it.
Good God! Can't a fellow simply say hello to someone?
Smarting from the undeserved insult, Mishlaevsky puffed out his chest and left the sitting room, his spurs clattering. In the dining room, he went up to lovely golden Yelena, his eyes expressing a certain alarm.
Hello, Yelena, my beautiful girl. May I wish you a very good morning?
He spoke in a hoarse baritone voice instead of his usual clear and strong tenor.
Lena, my beautiful girl, he exclaimed, his voice full of emotion. Don't be angry with me. I love you, and you must love me. Don't pay any attention to those boorish remarks yesterday. You don't really think I'm a bastard, do you, Lena?
Saying this, he flung his arms round Yelena and kissed her on both cheeks. In the sitting room, Anyuta's brush, in the form of a coxcomb, fell on the floor with a gentle thud. Strange things always happened to Anyuta whenever Mishlaevsky made an appearance in the Turbin's apartment. Household objects started spilling out of her hands. Knives would crash down, and if she was in the kitchen, dishes would fall off the stand on the sideboard. Anushka would become distracted, suddenly running out of the kitchen, and busy herself with the galoshes, wiping them with a rag until she could hear the clinking of short spurs set well down on the heels. Then, when Mishlaevsky's broad shoulders, sloping chin and blue breeches appeared, Anyuta would close her eyes and sidle out from her cramped, cunning little hiding place. And now, in the sitting room, having dropped the brush, she stood for a long time lost in thought, looking through the patterned curtains at the grey, cloudy sky in the distance.
Vitka, Vitka, Yelena said, shaking her head with its shining crown of hair resembling a theatre prop.
Just look at you, a perfectly healthy young man, and yet your behaviour last night. Sit down and have some tea, perhaps you'll feel better.
Do you know how absolutely gorgeous you look today, Lenotchka? And I swear, your housecoat fits you so well, Mishlaevsky said ingratiatingly, glancing into the mirrored depths of the sideboard.
Look, Karas, what a fantastic housecoat! Such a beautiful green, isn't it?
Yes, Yelena Vasilyevna, you're looking very beautiful,
Karas answered seriously and sincerely.
It's actually electric blue, clarified Yelena. Anyway, Vitya, why don't you get straight to the point and tell me what's wrong?
The fact is, Lena, my beautiful girl, that after what happened to me yesterday, I'm liable to have a migraine, and nobody is able to fight with a migraine.
All right, then. Look in the sideboard.
Thank you. Thank you. Just one little glass. Better than any aspirin.
Screwing up his eyes from the pain of it all, Mishlaevsky downed two tumblers of vodka, one after the other, taking them with limp gherkins left over from the evening before. Then he declaimed he felt as good as new, and expressed the wish for some tea with lemon.
Don't worry about me, Lenotchka, Alexei said hoarsely. I'm just going to enlist, and then I'll be straight back. And don't worry about any possible military action. We'll just wait in the city and repel any attack by that so-called president, the bastard.
Yes, but won't you be sent somewhere?
Karas shook his head reassuringly.
No, don't worry, Yelena Vasilyevna. Listen, in the first place, under no circumstances will the battalion be ready for action for at least 2 weeks. We still don't have any horses or ammunition. And secondly, even when it is ready, we shall definitely stay in the city anyway. The entire army, which is now in the process of formation, will be the city's garrison. Maybe a little later, when we have to advance on Moscow. But that may never happen.
We shall need to join up with Denikin rather earlier.
You don't need to console me, gentlemen. I'm not afraid of anything at all. On the contrary, I approve of your intentions.
Yelena indeed sounded cheerful, and the expression in her eyes indicated that her interest had already turned to matters of domestic concern.
Sufficient unto the day be the evil thereof.
Anyuta, she shouted, out on the veranda you'll find Viktor Viktorovich's washing. Take it, will you? Give it a good brushing and then wash it straight away.
Most reassuring of all, from Yelena's point of view, was the small, compact figure of blue-eyed Karas. The assured Karas sat there in his light brown army jacket, his eyes screwed up slightly, smoking and looking calm and nonchalant. They said goodbye in the hall.
May God keep and preserve you,
Yelena said solemnly, and made the sign of the cross over Alexei, then over Karas and Mishlaevsky. Mishlaevsky embraced her, and Karas, his greatcoat belted tightly round his waist, blushed as he tenderly kissed her on both hands.
Permission to report, Colonel, sir,
Karas said with a salute and gentle click of his spurs. The colonel sat at a small desk in a low green lounge chair, raised up on a kind of dais in the right-hand side of the shop. Behind him towered piles of blue cardboard boxes, bearing the inscription, Madame Anjou, Ladies Millinery, somewhat dimming the light coming from the dusty window hung with a patterned tulle curtain. The colonel had a pen in his hand. In actual fact, he wasn't a full colonel, but just a lieutenant colonel with broad gold epaulettes, two stripes, three stars, and crossed gold cannon. The colonel was a little older than Alexei Turbin, about 30 years old, certainly no more than 32. His sleek, clean-shaven face sported a black moustache, trimmed after the American fashion. Although he was clearly tired, the expression in his eyes was lively, thoughtful, and aware. The colonel was surrounded by primordial chaos. A couple of yards away, a fire was crackling in a small black stove with a black knobbly flue, occasionally dripping globules of black gunge as it snaked away over the partition and disappeared into the depths of the shop. Scraps of paper and red and green material cuttings littered the floor, not only on the raised platform, but also in the rest of the shop, extending into the recesses at the back. High up, right above the colonel's head, someone could be heard clucking away at a typewriter, like the alarm call of an anxious bird. When Turbin looked up, he saw that the sound was coming from behind a railing suspended right under the shop's ceiling. Someone's feet and rear in blue riding breeches could be seen behind the railing, but the head was invisible because the ceiling intervened. To the left, another machine was clattering away in an invisible pit in the floor, revealing only the bright epaulettes and blonde head of a volunteer, but neither his arms nor his legs. A multitude of faces and gold epaulettes with cannon flitted around the colonel. Nearby stood a large box with telephone receivers and wires, and next to the piles of hat boxes lay several coiled machine gun belts and a number of hand grenades, looking like tins of preserves with wooden handles. A sewing machine with a treadle stood under the colonel's left elbow, and by his right foot protruded the snout of a machine gun. Somewhere in the depths and semi-darkness, behind a curtain hanging from a gleaming rail, a voice could be heard on the telephone, clearly under pressure.
Yes, yes, speaking. Yes, yes, I'm telling you, yes!
Ring, ring went the bell, and what sounded like a small bird tweeting came from the invisible pit, as a young bass voice mumbled,
"Battalion headquarters here. Yes, yes."
"How can I help you?" the colonel asked Karras.
"Permit me to introduce you, Colonel, sir, to Lieutenant Viktor Mishlaevsky and Dr. Turbin. Lieutenant Mishlaevsky is serving at present in the 2nd Infantry Unit as a private and wishes to transfer to the battalion under your command as an artillery officer. Dr. Turbin requests appointment as a battalion medical officer."
When he had finished speaking, Karras lowered his hand from the salute position, whereupon Mishlaevsky saluted.
"Damn it, I wish I were in uniform," Alexei thought irritably, feeling awkward without a cap, dressed like some dolt in a black coat with a lambskin collar.
The colonel's eyes flitted over the doctor, then across to Mishlaevsky's face and greatcoat.
"Right, that's excellent," he said.
"And what unit were you with, Lieutenant?"
"A heavy battalion, Colonel,"
answered Mishlaevsky, referring to his position during the war with Germany.
"A heavy battalion, you say? That's very good indeed. The devil knows what they're doing shoving artillery officers into the infantry. What a mess."
"Not at all, Colonel, sir,"
Mishlaevsky replied, masking his challenging tone of voice with a little cough.
"I myself volunteered to join the infantry detachment when there was an urgent demand for troops to go to Post Volinsky, but now that the detachment is fully up to strength..."
"Very good. That meets with my complete approval," the colonel said.
And indeed, the expression in his eyes as he looked at Mishlaevsky was one of complete approval.
"I'm pleased to have met you. So, Doctor, you'd like to join us too?"
Turbin silently inclined his head, so as to avoid having to say, "Yes, sir," dressed as he was in only his coat with its lamb collar.
The colonel said, glancing out of the window. "That's a very good idea, you know, especially since sooner or later we may... Right,"
he suddenly broke off, screwing up his eyes slightly, and then continued more quietly.
"It's just that, how can I put it, there is one little matter, social theories and all that. You are a socialist, aren't you? Like all members of the intelligentsia?"
The colonel's eyes slid sideways. His whole manner, his lips, and his honeyed tone of voice expressed just how much he indeed wanted Turbin to be socialist, rather than anything else.
"Our battalion is called the Students' Battalion," the colonel said with an emotional smile, averting his eyes. "A little sentimental, of course, but I myself am a university man."
Turbin was extremely disappointed and astonished at this. "What has Karras been saying, damn it?" he thought, sensing at that moment Karras standing to his right. Without looking, he realized that Karras urgently wanted to communicate something, but it was impossible to know exactly what it was.
"I regret," Turbin suddenly blurted out, his cheek twitching, "that I am not a socialist, but a
monarchist. And I have to say, the very word socialist is anathema to me. And of all socialists, I hate Alexander Fyodorovich Kerensky most of all.
From behind his right shoulder, he heard a sound coming from Karas's lips. It would be very sad not to be with Karas and Vitya, he thought. But the devil take this socialist battalion. Damn it. The colonel glanced down fleetingly, and there was a sparkle in his eyes. He gestured to Turbin as if to indicate politely that he should keep his mouth shut.
That's a pity, he said. A great pity. Achievements of the revolution and so on. I have orders from above not to accept any monarchist elements. The population as a whole needs restraint, you understand. Moreover, the hetman, with whom we are in the most immediate and direct contact, has, you know... A pity, a great pity.
As he said this, the colonel's voice not only did not contain any note of regret, but on the contrary, he sounded positively pleased, and his eyes expressed the exact opposite of what he was saying. Aha, thought Turbin, understanding the position perfectly. I am an idiot, and the colonel is far from stupid. Judging by his face, he's probably a careerist, but I don't mind that.
I don't know now what's the best thing to do. At the present moment, as you know, said the colonel, particularly emphasizing the word present, I repeat, at the present moment, our most immediate task is to defend the city and the hetman from Petliura's gang, as well as possibly from the Bolsheviks. We'll just have to wait and see. Where did you serve, Doctor, before this, may I ask?
In 1915, after graduation, I worked as a junior doctor in a clinic for venereal diseases, and then as a medical officer with the Belgrade Hussars, and after that in a mobile field hospital. At the present moment, I am demobilized and have my own private practice.
Cadet, the colonel ordered, ask the senior officer to report to me.
A head disappeared down into the pit, followed by the appearance of a young, dark-skinned, lively-looking and eager officer wearing a lambskin fur cap with a purple striped top and a grey greatcoat a la Mishlaevsky with a tightly fastened belt and a revolver. His crumpled gold epaulettes indicated that he was a staff captain.
Captain Studzinski, the colonel said to the young officer, be so kind as to send a message to headquarters requesting the immediate transfer to me of Lieutenant, Mishlaevsky, said Mishlaevsky, saluting. Lieutenant Mishlaevsky from the 2nd Infantry Detachment as an artillery officer, and with it, a message concerning Dr.,
Turbin.
Dr. Turbin, I would very much like him to become battalion medical officer. Please request that he be appointed immediately.
Yes, Colonel, sir, answered the officer in a foreign accent, and saluted.
A Pole, thought Turbin.
You, Lieutenant, should not return to your infantry unit, the colonel said to Mishlaevsky. Then, turning to the captain, he said, the lieutenant will take over the 4th platoon.
Yes, Colonel, sir.
Yes, Colonel, sir. As for you, Doctor, as of this moment, you are a serving officer. I would like you to report today, within the hour, to the parade ground in front of the Alexandrovsky High School.
Yes, Colonel, sir.
Issue the doctor with the uniform immediately.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir, shouted the bass voice from the pit.
No, do you hear? No, I'm telling you, no, came a shout from behind the partition.
Ring, cheep, cheep, chirped the bird down in the pit.
Can you hear me? Liberty News! Liberty News! Your new daily Liberty News! Shouted the newspaper boy, his hair wrapped in a woman's scarf. Petliura demoralized! African troops arrive in Odessa! Liberty News!
Within an hour, Turbin was back home. The silver epaulettes were located in the depths of the drawer in Turbin's study, next to the sitting room. The study itself was sparsely furnished and rather cramped, but nonetheless comfortable. There were white curtains on the glass door, opening out onto a balcony, a desk with books and an inkwell, shelves of medicine bottles and instruments, and a couch made up with a clean sheet.
Leonochka, if for some reason I'm back late today and someone comes, tell them there's no surgery. It won't be any of my regular patients. Quick as you can, my girl.
Having turned back the lapels of Turbin's army jacket, Yelena was hastily sewing on the epaulettes. She had already sewn the others, khaki green with a black stripe, onto the greatcoat. A few minutes later, Turbin dashed out of the front door, glancing at the white board on the way. Dr. A.V. Turbin,
venereal diseases and syphilis, 606-914. Surgery hours, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Sticking on the amended times of 5 p.m. to 7 p.m, he set off up St. Alexei's Hill at a run.
Liberty News!
Turbin stopped, bought a copy, and continued on his way, opening the paper as he went. Independent Democratic Newspaper, published daily, 13th of December 1918. Issues relating to external trade, and in particular trade with Germany, compel us... But where on earth is it? My hands are freezing. According to our correspondent, negotiations are taking place in Odessa concerning the disembarkation of 2 divisions of black colonial troops. Consul Enno rejects any suggestion that... The son of a bitch, that newspaper lad. Deserters who turned up yesterday at army headquarters at Postvolinsky have spoken of the increasing demoralization in the ranks of Petliura's forces. 2 days ago, a cavalry regiment in the Khorasten region fired on an infantry regiment of Cossack riflemen. Among Petliura's forces, a strong desire for peace has been observed. Petliura's little adventure is clearly coming to an end. According to the same source, Colonel Bolbotun has rebelled against Petliura and gone off with his regiment and 4 guns to an unknown destination. Bolbotun inclines towards support of the Hetman. The peasants hate Petliura for his requisitions. The mobilization orders he has published in the villages have had no success. The peasants are ignoring them in their masses by taking to hiding in the forests.
It's possible, I suppose. Oh, damn this bloody frost. Sorry.
There's no need to push like that, my dear sir. Newspapers should be read at home. Sorry.
We have always maintained that Petliura's little adventure...
What a bastard. Oh, you bastard.
Don't let Petliura have his way. Come join the volunteers today.
Why so glum today, Ivan Ivanovich?
My wife's gone down with Petliura. She did a Bolbotun on me this morning.
Hearing this witticism, Turbin's expression changed, and he angrily scrunched up the newspaper and hurled it onto the pavement. Then, suddenly, his attention was caught by the boom-boom of heavy gunfire, followed by a series of dull thuds coming seemingly from the depths of the earth, from somewhere outside the city.
What the devil's that?
Turbin turned abruptly, picked up the crumpled ball of newspaper, straightened it out, and read through the first page again more carefully. In the Irpin region, there have been clashes between our advanced forces and individual groups of Petliura's bandits. All reported calm in the Serebryansk area. No change at the Red Tavern. In the Boyak area, a fierce attack by a regiment of Hetmanite Cossacks has dispersed a group some 1,500 strong. 2 men taken prisoner. The roar of gunfire could also be heard in the grey winter sky, somewhere to the far southwest of the city. Turbin suddenly turned pale, his mouth open. Mechanically, he stuffed the newspaper into his pocket. Crowds of people were moving slowly from the boulevard and along Vladimirskaya Street. Many people in black coats were walking directly on the road, while peasant women could be glimpsed on the pavement. A horseman of the State Guard rode commandingly along. His large horse, its ears twitching, looked around nervously as it moved sideways along the road. The rider seemed rather confused. From time to time he would shout something, brandishing his whip to show who he was, but nobody paid any attention. At the front of the crowd, the gold copes of bearded priests could be seen bobbing along, a religious banner waving above their heads. Small boys were dashing up from all directions.
News!
Shouted a newspaper boy, making a beeline for the crowd. Sous-chefs in their white, flat-topped hats ran out from the dark interior of the Metropole restaurant. The crowd spread out over the snow like black ink over paper. A number of long yellow boxes were swaying along above the heads of the crowd. When the first box drew level with Turbin, he was able to make out the charcoal inscription scrawled on its side, Ensign Yutsevich. On the second box, Ensign Ivanov. And on the third, Ensign Orlov. Suddenly, there was a howl from the crowd. A grey-haired woman, her hat on the back of her head, dashed from the pavement into the crowd, stumbling and dropping various packages along the way.
"What's going on? Vanya!"
she yelled. Someone turned pale and ran off to one side. A peasant woman started howling, followed by another behind her.
Lord Jesus Christ,
Tobin heard someone mutter behind him. Someone pushed him in the back, and he could sense someone's breath on his neck.
Lord, what terrible times we're living in. So people are being killed now, is that it?
I don't know anything except what I can see here in front of me.
What? What? What's going on? Who's being buried?
Vanya!
Someone yelled in the crowd.
They're the officers who were murdered in Popolyucha.
A voice boomed hastily, anxious to be the first with the news.
They had got as far as Popolyucha, where they spent the night, but some peasants, together with a group of Petlura's men, surrounded them and simply slaughtered them. Yes, just like that. Slaughtered. Their eyes were gouged out, and their epaulettes carved onto their shoulders. Completely mutilated.
Oh my God! So that's what happened.
Two more yellow coffins went by. Ensign Korovin. Ensign Gert.
What times we're living in, just think.
Internecine fighting.
What on earth do you mean?
They fell asleep, apparently.
Serves them right,
someone hissed darkly behind Turbin, and he immediately saw red. Faces and caps flashed past. Turbin thrust his hand between two necks and grasped the sleeve of the man's black coat in a pincer-like grip. The man turned round with a horrified look.
What did you say?
Turbin hissed, relaxing his grip.
Please, sir, I beg you,
the man answered, shaking with fright.
I didn't say anything. I didn't open my mouth. What do you want?
He asked, his voice quavering.
The man's beak-like nose paled, and Turbin realized at once he'd made a mistake. He'd seized hold of the wrong man. The beak-like nose belonged to a face expressing nothing but the best of intentions. Its mouth was unable to speak, and its eyes were rolling from terror.
Turbin let go of the man's sleeve, and in cold fury began looking around at everybody, searching among the seething mass of caps, heads, and collars. His left hand was poised to grab, and his right hand was in his pocket, firmly holding onto the handle of his Browning revolver. The priests walked past, singing mournfully, and a woman in a shawl sobbed. The man he was looking for seemed to have vanished into thin air, so there was nobody he could grab. The last coffin floated by. Ensign Morskoy. Several sledges went past at speed.
News!
Somebody shouted in a hoarse falsetto right by Turbin's ear. Turbin pulled out the crumpled newspaper from his pocket and, without thinking what he was doing, jabbed it twice into the newspaper boy's face.
Here's your news for you, he said, grinding his teeth. Here's your news, you little swine.
As soon as he'd said this, Turbin's fit of rage left him. Dropping his newspapers, the lad slipped and sat down in a snowdrift. His face puckered up, and he began to weep patently false tears, but the expression in his eyes was one of undiluted and far from false hatred.
Why did you do that? What have I done?
The lad whined in an attempt at a wail and started digging into the snow. Someone looked at Turbin in astonishment, but he was afraid to say anything. Feeling ashamed and aware of the absurdity of what he'd done, Turbin tucked his head into his shoulders and, turning sharply, ran from the street onto the huge familiar square in the park of the Aleksandrovsky High School. Past the gas lamp, past the white wall on the side of the large circular museum building, and past several pits in the ground filled with snow-covered bricks. Behind him, he could still hear the shouts from the street.
News! Daily Democratic newspaper!
The huge, peaceful edifice of the school that Turbin knew so well, with its four stories and its 180 columns, stood along one side of the square. Turbin had spent 8 years as a student there. Every spring for 8 years, during the breaks between classes, he had run around that very same square, and in the winter, when the classrooms were full of choking dust and the square was covered in a cold, solid mass of snow, he used to stand at the window looking out onto it. For 8 years within these peaceful brick walls, Turbin and his younger fellow pupils Karas and Mishlaevsky had been educated and nurtured. And it was exactly 8 years ago that Turbin had last seen the school park. For some reason, his heart contracted from fear. A black cloud suddenly seemed to have covered the sky, and a tornado had apparently appeared out of nowhere and wiped his life away,
just like a huge wave washing away a jetty. 8 years as a student. How many absurdities, how much sorrow and despair had he lived through as a small boy. And yet, how happy he had been too. One grey day after another, on and on. Like Julius Caesar, he had been given the lowest possible mark for cosmography, and from then on he had always hated the subject. But then there was the spring. Springtime, with noisy, echoing classrooms, the girl pupils walking along the boulevards in their green pinafores, the chestnuts in May, and above all, the ever-present lighthouse pointing the way ahead, to university, to freedom and life, in other words. Do you understand the significance of that word, university? Sunsets over the Dnieper, freedom, money, the life force, and fame. And he had lived through it all. The teachers with their inscrutable expressions, the swimming pools, still featuring in his dreams, from which the water always seemed to be draining, but which always remained full, and the endless discussions concerning the difference in character between Lienski and Onegin, Socrates's scandalous behaviour, when the Order of Jesuits was founded, the dates of Pompey's campaign, and of someone else's campaign, and of campaign after campaign over 2,000 years of history. But this was far from all. After 8 years of school, with the swimming pools left far behind, came the corpses in the anatomy theatre, the whitewashed hospital wards, the glassy silence of the operating theatres, and then 3 years being tossed about in the saddle, the dressing of wounds, the humiliations, and the suffering. Oh, the damned cesspit of war. And here he was once again, back in the same old school grounds, running across the square, feeling ill and overwrought, clutching the Browning in his pocket, running God knows where and what for. Probably to protect that very same life, that future for whose sake he had worried himself sick over swimming pools and those blasted pedestrians, one setting off from point A and the other setting off to meet him from point B. The blackened windows of the school seemed frozen in complete gloom. It was immediately apparent that their stillness was that of the grave. It seemed very strange that in the centre of a city, in the midst of all the chaos, bustle and commotion, there should be this dead, four-tiered ship that had once carried scores of thousands of lives onto the open sea. It seemed that nobody was looking after it any longer, and that there was neither sound nor movement of any kind in its windows and under its walls, decorated with yellow paint dating from the time of Nicholas II. A layer of virgin snow covered the roofs, crowned the tops of the chestnut trees, and spread evenly over the square. Only a few tracks showed that someone had recently crossed it. But the main point was that not only did nobody know what had happened to everything, but that nobody cared. Nobody cared who was still studying here in this ship, or if there weren't any students any more, why that should be so, or where the watchman might be. Why were there those fearful-looking blunt-snouted mortars protruding from under the line of chestnuts by the railing? Why was there a weapons store in the school? Whose was it? Who? What for? Nobody knew the answers to these questions, just as nobody knew what had become of Madame Anjou, and why there were bombs in her boutique lying beside the empty hat boxes.
"Deploy!"
someone roared, and the mortars began to move and creep slowly forward. About 200 people were busy running in various directions, squatting down and leaping about near the huge metal wheels of the mortars. There were glimpses of yellow sheepskin coats, grey greatcoats, and fur caps, military, khaki, and blue students' caps. Turbin walked across the imposing square to find the four mortars in a row, gaping at him. The hurried drill procedure around the guns had ended, and the motley recently recruited soldiers of the mortar battalion stood to attention in two ranks.
"Captain!" sang out Mishlaevsky's voice. "Platoon present and correct, sir!"
Captain Studzinski stepped out in front of the ranks of soldiers, took a step backwards, and shouted,
"By the left! Quick march!"
The ranks swayed and marched off raggedly, the snow crunching under their feet. As they marched by, Turbin glimpsed many familiar, typical student faces, including that of Karas, at the head of the third platoon. Still uncertain where he was going and for what purpose,
he started crunching through the snow in step with the platoon. Karras, concerned that his platoon was out of step, went out in front of his men and, walking backwards, shouted, "Left! Left! Hup! Left!" The company snaked towards the dark basement entrance to the school. One after the other, the ranks of soldiers were swallowed up by its black maw. The interior of the school was even more lifeless and gloomy than its exterior. The crashing echo of marching feet quickly brought the stone walls and eerie darkness to life. Strange sounds began to fly around under the vaults like animated demons. With the ponderous sound of marching feet came the squeak of alarmed rats scuttling about under the floorboards. The company marched along endless, dark, brick-paved basement corridors until they came to a huge hall lit by a miserly light trickling through narrow barred windows and musty cobwebs. The silence was broken by the hellish din of hammers. People were opening boxes of shells, removing seemingly endless numbers of cartridge belts, together with round cartridge cases for Lewis guns, looking like cream cakes. Grey and black machine guns emerged, resembling evil-looking mosquitoes. There was a clattering of nuts and bolts, a ripping of pliers, and, over in the corner, the high-pitched whine of a saw. Cadets were unloading piles of frozen and sorry-looking fur caps, folded greatcoats that were as rigid as iron, belts that had become stiff, cartridge pouches and water bottles wrapped in cloth.
"Look lively there,"
Studzinski could be heard saying. A group of about six officers in faded gold epaulettes swirled around the room like club moss on top of a pond. Mishlaevsky's strong tenor voice was singing some song or other.
"Doctor,"
Studzinski shouted from out of the gloom,
"please be so kind as to take the medical assistants and give them their instructions."
Two students appeared in front of Turbin. One of them, short and agitated, had a red cross on the sleeve of his student coat. The other was wearing a grey coat and a fur cap that he kept on having to adjust because it was slipping down over his eyes. "The boxes of medical supplies are over there," Turbin said. "Take the shoulder satchels out and give me my doctor's bag and equipment. Make sure you give each artilleryman two of the individual medical packs with a brief explanation how they are to open them in an emergency." Mishlaevsky's head emerged above the seething mass of soldiers. He climbed up onto a box, took his rifle, pulled back the bolt, and slamming in a cartridge clip, took aim at the window. Pulled back the bolt again, took aim, repeating the action again and again, showering the cadets with expended bullets. The basement began to sound like a factory. With a general din and the clatter of bolts being pulled, the cadets loaded their rifles.
"Anybody who can't do it, take care," Mishlaevsky sang out. "Cadets, show the students how it's done."
When everyone had pulled the straps of cartridge pouches and shoulder satchels over their heads, it was as if a miracle had taken place. What had been a motley, disparate bunch of men was now a single, compact unit with a bristling row of bayonets wavering unsteadily over their heads like a steel brush.
"All officers to me, please,"
Studzinski said from out of the darkness. Studzinski addressed them quietly in the dark corridor, to the sound of softly clinking spurs.
"Well, impressions?"
There was a stamping of spurs, and Mishlaevsky, nonchalantly and adeptly placing the tips of his fingers in his cap band, stepped forward towards the staff captain and said,
"I have 15 men in my platoon who haven't the first idea how to use a rifle. Makes life difficult."
Studzinski looked up, as though inspired, towards the window that was letting in the final feeble ray of light into the basement.
"What about morale?"
he asked. Again, it was Mishlaevsky who spoke.
Not helped by seeing those coffins. The students were upset. It hit them badly. They saw what was going on through the railings."
Studzinski's dark, unwavering eyes flicked over him.
"Do all you can to raise morale."
They all dispersed to the clink of spurs.
"Cadet Pavlovsky!"
roared Mishlaevsky in the armament store, sounding like Radames in Aida. The store's stone walls resounded with the shout of cadets' voices calling for Pavlovsky.
"Here, sir."
"A student of Alexeyevsky Academy?"
"Yes, sir."
"Right then, let's have a song that will blow the roof off. Put such force into it that Petlura will drop dead, damn him to hell."
Under the stone-vaulted ceiling, a clear, high voice started singing, "A Gunner Boy, I Was Born." This was taken up by several tenor voices from among the forest of bayonets. Taught and nurtured by the brigade, the entire group seemed to tremble with excitement as they all quickly picked up the tune by ear, until suddenly the whole room was echoing with the elemental sound of a bass chorus exploding into song. Baptized by the sound of gunfire, wrapped in lush velvet, and the sound of gunfire. The song rang in everyone's ears and heads, as well as in the boxes of ammunition, and even some dusty glasses standing abandoned on the sloping window ledges trembled and tinkled. In my cradle of anchor ropes, the gun crew rocked me to sleep. Studzinski seized hold of two pink-cheeked ensigns from the melee of greatcoats, bayonets, and machine guns.
"Go to the vestibule and take the cover off the painting there, quick as you can,"
he ordered in a hurried whisper, and the two of them raced off. The guards' cadets sing as down the street they pound, the trumpets and drums and the cymbals resound. The empty stone shell of the building now thundered and roared to the terrifying sound of a march, and the rats, cowering in their deep underground lairs, were too petrified to move.
"Hey up!" Karas shouted shrilly. "Come on, put some life into it, students of Alexeyevsky Academy!"
Mishlaevsky yelled in his clear tenor voice.
"This isn't a funeral!"
The seamstresses, maids, and laundry girls watch the cadets as they march away. Instead of a grey, indeterminate caterpillar shuffling along, an organized troop of men bristling with bayonets moved down the corridor, and the floor bent and groaned under the heavy tread of their feet. They marched along the seemingly endless corridor, then up to the first floor and into the gigantic vestibule, lit by the light streaming through its glass cupola. The first to arrive were already there, waiting a little restlessly. Mounted on his rearing thoroughbred stallion, Emperor Alexander, slightly balding and with a radiant smile, his saddlecloth embellished with imperial monograms, charged along ahead of his troops, his white-feathered tricorn hat cocked to one side. Bestowing smile after smile on them, full of a rather disingenuous charm, Alexander gestured with his baton to show them the regiments who fought at Borodino. The battlefield was strewn with piles of cannonballs, and the entire background of the 14-foot canvas was taken up by a black forest of bayonets.
"What a battle it was," Pavlovsky sang.
"Yes, what a battle it was," thundered the basses. "No Russian will ever forget the glorious day of Borodino."
The dazzling Alexander galloped on and upwards towards heaven, with the cover that had concealed the painting for a whole year lying at the feet of his stallion.
"Just look at the blessed Tsar Alexander, won't you? Come on, keep in step there. Hup, left, left," yelled Mishlaevsky as the file of troops climbed the staircase with the heavy tread of Tsar Alexander's infantry.
Once past the conqueror of Napoleon, the squadron stopped singing as they wheeled into the vast assembly hall and stood there in their dense ranks, bayonets waving. The hall was filled with a whitish, rather gloomy light, and behind the covers over the paintings on the walls, the figures of previous tsars could be discerned, peering down like pale ghosts onto the assembled company. Studzinski took a step backwards and glanced at his wristwatch. At that moment, a cadet ran up to him and whispered something in his ear. Those standing nearby could hear what he said.
"The battalion commander!"
Studzinski gestured to his officers, who ran to the ranks and dressed them. Studzinski went out into the corridor to meet the commander. His spurs jingling, Colonel Malyshev was climbing the stairs towards the entrance to the assembly hall, turning to glance at the painting of Alexander on the way. His curved Caucasian saber, with its cherry-coloured sword knot, dangled at his left side. He was wearing a black cap of luxuriant velvet and a long greatcoat with a huge slit at the back. He was looking thoughtful. Studzinski went quickly up to him and saluted.
"They all have uniforms?" asked Malyshev.
"Yes, sir. All orders have been carried out."
"And?"
"They will fight, but they're totally lacking in experience. 120 cadets are in charge of 80 students, none of whom knows how to hold a rifle."
Malyshev frowned, but he said nothing.
I am very fortunate to have such good officers, Studzinski continued, especially the one who's just joined me, Mishlaevsky. We shall manage somehow.
Right, but now I want you to see to it that the battalion, with the exception of the officers and 60 of the best and most experienced cadets, who will stay behind to guard the mortars, the ammunition store, and the building generally, disperses to their homes to be back here at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. Studzinski's face expressed blank astonishment. His mouth open, he glared at the colonel with an extremely defiant expression.
But, Colonel, sir...
In his agitation, Studzinski started to stress all his words in the Polish way, on the penultimate syllable.
With all due respect, that will not be possible. The only way the battalion will be able to maintain its fighting readiness will be if it stays here for the night.
The colonel there and then demonstrated that he possessed a new quality, the ability to erupt into a fit of rage on the grandest scale. His neck and cheeks turned a brownish red, and his eyes flashed fire.
Captain, he said furiously, I shall ask that an official complaint be made against you, so that your duties as an officer will cease, and you will become a lecturer whose job will be to instruct senior officers. And I will not find that at all pleasant, as I have always supposed you, of all people, to be an experienced officer, and not a civilian professor. So I don't need to be lectured, and I don't need any advice from you. Listen to what I've been saying and remember it. And then, when you've remembered, you are to carry out my orders.
The two of them stood there, glaring at each other. A reddish glow crept over Studzinski's neck and cheeks, and his lips trembled.
Yes, sir, he said gratingly.
Yes, sir. Now send them home. They are to sleep without their weapons, and then be back here tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. But that's not all. They are to disperse in small groups, rather than in their platoons, and they are to remove their splendid epaulets so as not to attract any attention from idle people.
A ray of understanding flashed in Studzinski's eyes, and his sense of outrage subsided.
Yes, sir, Colonel, sir.
The colonel's mood changed abruptly.
Alexander Bronislavovich, I have long known you as an experienced fighting officer, but you also know me, don't you? So no hard feelings, then? Resentment at such a time would be inappropriate. Please forget the fact that I spoke so harshly to you. But then, you also...
Studzinski's face flooded with color.
Yes, Colonel, I'm sorry.
Well, excellent then. Let's not waste any more time, otherwise the men will lose the will to fight. Everything will depend on what happens tomorrow, when it will all have become clearer. But I'll just say this for now. Don't bother with the mortars at all tomorrow. There won't be any horses or shells. Instead, you are to start by concentrating on their rifle drill. Shooting and more shooting. Ensure that by midday tomorrow, the battalion is capable of shooting as well as any top-class regiment. And all experienced cadets are to be given grenades. Understood?
Deep shadows crossed Studzinski's forehead. He had been listening carefully to everything the colonel had been saying.
May I ask you a question, sir?
I know what you want to ask me. And no, you may not. But I'll answer it anyway. The situation's terrible. It has been worse, but rarely as bad as this. Now do you understand?
Yes, sir.
So then, the colonel said, his voice considerably lower, you understand why I don't want anybody to spend a night in this stone death trap at such a dangerous time, and I certainly don't want to be responsible for the deaths of 200 young men, 120 of whom don't even know how to use a rifle. Studzinski said nothing in reply.
Right then. We'll deal with the rest this evening. There'll be enough time. Let's go and have a look at the battalion.
They went into the assembly hall.
Officers, attention!
Bawled Studzinski.
Good day, gentlemen.
From behind Malyshev's back, Studzinski gestured at the men like an anxious theater director, and the gray, bristling ranks responded with such a roar of greeting that the windows shook. Malyshev gave the ranks a cheerful once-over and brought his hand down from the salute.
Splendid! Gentlemen, he said, I will not waste any words. I am not a great public speaker, as I am not in the habit of addressing meetings, and therefore I will be brief. We will be hitting that son-of-a-bitch Petliura where it hurts, and you may rest assured we will beat him.
Among you are graduates from the Vladimir, Konstantin, and Alexeyevsky military academies, and not once has any of you fine fellows from these academies ever brought disgrace on their institutions. And there are many present who were students of this famous school. Its ancient walls are looking down on you, and I trust you will not do anything to make them ashamed of you. Gentlemen of the Mortar Battalion, we shall defend this great city from the besieging marauders. We simply need to start firing at this wonderful so-called president with our 6-inch guns, and all he'll have to show for it will be a pair of dirty underpants. God rot his slimy soul. Encouraged by the colonel's cheerful humor, the bristling, dense ranks responded with a roar of laughter. Gentlemen, do your best. Once again, as if from the wings, there was a theatrical gesture from Studzinski, and once again, the ranks responded with a roar that disturbed several layers of dust as they raised 3 cheers for their commanding officer. 10 minutes later, the assembly hall, just as on the battlefield at Borodino, was dotted with hundreds of weapons in stacks. 2 sentries stood in the shadows at either end of the dusty parquet floor, guarding the forest of bayonets. Somewhere far off, down below, came the hasty clatter of footsteps as the men, following their orders, dispersed. Officers could be heard shouting in the corridors, accompanied by the rumble and metallic clatter of feet. Studzinski was himself posting the sentries. Then, suddenly, again in the corridors, came the sound of a bugle call flooding through the entire school. If there was any note of anxiety in the sound, it was unconvincing, and the halting, broken nature of the playing indicated that it was not warning of any real danger. In the corridor above the landing, bounded by the double staircase leading to the vestibule, a cadet was standing, puffing out his cheeks. Faded ribbons of the Order of St. George dangled down from the tarnished brass instrument. Mishlaevsky, his feet spread wide apart like a pair of compasses, stood in front of the bugler, instructing and testing him.
Not so hard. No, like this. Blow out, like a bellows. That old thing's not been played for ages.
How about the general alarm? Ta-ta-tam, ta-tam, went the bugler, spreading alarm and despondency among the rats. The light in the assembly hall was fading rapidly. Malyshev and Alexei Turbin stood among the stacks of rifles. Malyshev gave Turbin a rather suspicious look at first, but then a welcoming smile spread over his face.
Well, Doctor, how are things going? Everything all right in the medical section?
Yes, sir.
In that case, Doctor, you can go home, and you can tell the medical orderlies they can go too, but tell them that they must be here at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning along with the others. As for you...
Here Malyshev paused for a moment, concentrated in thought.
As for you, I would like you to be here tomorrow at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Until then, you are free.
Malyshev again thought for a moment.
And you know what? Don't wear your epaulettes for the time being.
Looking a little embarrassed, he continued,
Our plans won't get very far if we draw attention to ourselves. So then, here tomorrow at 2 o'clock.
Yes, sir. Turbin shuffled his feet. Malyshev took out his cigarette case and offered him a cigarette. In response, Turbin lit a match. 2 red pinpoints started to glow, clearly indicating just how dark it had become. Malyshev glanced anxiously up at the dully shining arc lights on the ceiling, then went out into the corridor.
Lieutenant Mishlaevsky, please come here for a moment, he called. I would like you to be in total charge of the electric lighting. Ensure that the building is fully lit as soon as possible. Be so good as to ensure that you have such control over the lighting that you are able not only to turn it on everywhere, but also to turn it off. You have complete responsibility for the building's lighting arrangements.
Mishlaevsky saluted and turned abruptly on his heels. There was a final squeak from the bugle. Mishlaevsky, his spurs jingling, clattered down the main staircase so rapidly that he could have been on skates. A moment later, and the thunderous sound of hammering fists and yelled commands could be heard coming up from somewhere in the depths of the building. This was followed by a sudden blaze of light in the main entranceway downstairs that led into the vestibule, dimly illuminating the portrait of the Tsar Alexander. His eyes shining with pleasure, Malyshev turned to Turbin.
There's a real officer for you, damn it! Did you see that?
At that moment, a small figure appeared on the staircase, slowly climbing the steps. When it reached the first landing, Malyshev and Turbin, hanging over the banisters, could see it more clearly. The figure was moving with feeble, tottering steps, shaking his white head. He was wearing a wide, double-breasted jacket with silver buttons and green lapels, and holding an enormous key in his shaking hands. Mishlaevsky followed him up the stairs, exhorting him every so often.
"Come on, old fellow, look lively. Stop crawling along like some slow-witted beetle."
You,
spluttered the old man as he shuffled up the stairs. Suddenly, Karas dived out of the gloom on the landing, followed by another taller officer, then two cadets, and finally the pointed snout of a machine gun. Horrified, the old man stumbled, then bent down and bowed to the waist before the machine gun.
"Your Excellency," he mumbled.
With trembling fingers, the old man poked around in the semi-gloom and opened an oblong box on the wall to reveal a white spot of light shining inside. He placed his hand inside the box. There was a click, and suddenly the whole upper area of the vestibule, the entrance to the assembly hall, and the corridor were flooded with light. The darkness turned and fled into the distance as far as it could go. Mishlaevsky immediately seized hold of the key, and placing his hand in the box, began to experiment, clicking and pulling the black switches. The light, so dazzling that it appeared pink, now came on, now vanished again. The globe lights in the assembly hall flared up and then went out. Soon, two lights at the end of the corridor went on, and the darkness, somersaulting, disappeared for good.
"How's that down below?" shouted Mishlaevsky.
"No, off,"
someone replied from the vestibule.
"Wait, it's on again."
After many attempts, Mishlaevsky finally succeeded in turning on the light in the assembly hall, the corridor, and over the Alexander painting. He locked the box and put the key in his pocket.
"Off you go now and have a sleep, old fellow," Mishlaevsky said soothingly. "Everything's fine now."
The old man's short-sighted eyes blinked nervously.
"But what about the key, Your Excellency? The key? Will you keep hold of the key?"
"Yes, that is exactly what I intend to do. Keep hold of the key."
Still trembling, the old man slowly began to leave.
"Cadet?"
A stout, red-faced cadet snapped to attention by the box and stood motionless.
"Unhindered access to the switch box is to be permitted to the battalion commander, the senior officer, and myself, but to nobody else. In the case of an emergency, and if ordered by one of those three officers, you may break open the box. But whatever happens, make sure you don't damage the switchboard."
"Yes, sir."
Mishlaevsky approached Alexei Turbin and whispered,
"Did you see Maxim?"
"My God, yes, I did," came Turbin's whispered reply. The battalion commander stood by the entrance to the assembly hall, a thousand lights playing on the silver edge of his saber. He called Mishlaevsky over to him and said,
"So, Lieutenant, I'm so glad you've joined us. Good man."
"Pleased to be of service, Colonel."
"All that's left for you now is to sort out the heating here in the assembly hall for the cadets on shift duty, and I'll take care of the rest. I'll make sure you have something to eat and some vodka. Not much, but enough to keep you warm."
Mishlaevsky smiled charmingly at the colonel and cleared his throat appreciatively. But Turbin didn't listen to any more of their conversation. Leaning over the banister, he did not take his eyes off the white-haired figure until it disappeared out of sight. He was overcome by a feeling of emptiness and sadness. As he stood there, leaning on the cold banister, he remembered a particular event with especial clarity. A crowd of students of all ages was streaming excitedly along this very same corridor. Maxim, the thick-set school beadle, grabbed at two small, dark figures in the front of the crowd.
"Well, well, well," he mumbled. "The school inspector will be so pleased at the opportunity to feast his eyes upon Mr. Turbin and Mr. Mishlaevsky, particularly on the occasion of the school patron's visit. He will be so pleased, so extraordinarily pleased."
These words of Maxim, it has to be said, were shot through with malicious irony. Only someone with the most perverted of tastes could have derived any pleasure from the sight presented by Messrs. Turbin and Mishlaevsky, particularly on the joyous occasion of the school patron's visit. Mr. Mishlaevsky, firmly grasped by Maxim's left hand, had a split upper lip, and his left sleeve was hanging by a thread. And Mr. Turbin, gripped by Maxim's other hand, had lost his belt, and not only all his shirt buttons, but also all his fly buttons had flown off, exposing his body and underclothes in the most scandalous way to anybody who cared to take a look.
"Let go of us, please, Maxim, be a good chap,"
implored Turbin and Mishlaevsky, looking up at Maxim, all expression draining from their blood-stained faces.
"That's it, Max! That's wonderful! Give him what for?"
the boys behind them shouted excitedly.
"He can't be allowed to get away with beating up his juniors!"
Oh my God, what a day that was. Such sunshine, such a racket, such noise. Maxim then was quite different from the way he looked today, white-haired, melancholy, and impoverished. His hair then was black and bristly, with only a few strands of grey showing through. He had metal claws rather than hands, and a medallion the size of a carriage wheel hung round his neck. Ah yes, the wheel, rolling on from village B, making n number of revolutions, only to arrive, finally, at a stony void. God, it's so cold. We must defend now. But what, exactly? Emptiness? The hollow sound of footsteps? Oh, Alexander, will you really be able to save the dying building with your Borodino regiment? Come on, come to life, and bring them all down from the canvas. They'd defeat Petliura. Turbin's legs carried him downstairs of their own accord. Maxim! He wanted to shout, but then he slowed down and stopped altogether. He imagined Maxim downstairs in the basement apartment where the caretakers lived. No doubt he would have forgotten everything by now, and he would be sitting by the stove, trembling and crying. But Turbin was depressed enough without worrying about that. Enough of this stupid sentimentality. Everyone had wasted their lives being too sentimental. Enough. And yet, when Turbin had dismissed the medical orderlies, he found himself in an empty, dimly lit classroom, with blackboards looking down from the walls and desks standing in rows. Unable to restrain himself, he opened the lid of one of the desks and sat down. Everything felt so difficult, awkward, and uncomfortable. The blackboard was too close for comfort. Yes, he could swear this was the classroom, or perhaps the one next door. The exact same view of the city from the window. Over there towered the lifeless mass of the university building. And yes, there was the boulevard, as straight as an arrow, lined with lamplight, the box-like houses interspersed with dark gaps, the walls, the sky rising to infinity. And outside, it was like a performance of the opera Christmas Eve, with the snow and the lights dancing and twinkling. I really would like to know what the shooting's about at Sviatoshin. It all sounded pretty harmless and distant, as if they were firing through cotton wool. Boom. Boom. That's enough, Turbin said to himself and closed the desk lid. He went out into the corridor, past the sentries, and through the vestibule out into the street. A machine gun was standing in the front entrance. The street was practically empty of pedestrians, and thick snow was falling. That night, the colonel was very busy. He made a large number of trips from the school to Madame Anjou's boutique just a stone's throw away, and back again. By midnight, everything was operating well and at full stretch. Hissing faintly, the arc lamps were bathing the school in a pinkish glow. The assembly hall had warmed up considerably. All evening the fires had been raging in the ancient stoves in the library alcoves along the sides of the main hall. On Mishlaevsky's orders, the cadets had been stoking the stoves with copies of the literary journals Notes of the Fatherland and Library for Reading for the year 1863. Later, throughout the night, they had used old school desks, chopping them up to the clatter of axes. With two glasses of vodka inside them, the colonel had kept his promise and provided half a bucket of the stuff, enough to warm them up. Studzinski and Mishlaevsky each kept 2 hourly shifts throughout the night, taking turns to sleep on greatcoats alongside the cadets by the stove, the shadows and red glow from the fire playing on their faces. Then they would get up and check the sentry posts. Karras, together with a group of cadets manning machine guns, kept watch by the garden exits, while four cadets wearing sheepskin coats stood guard an hour at a time over the wide-barreled mortars. At Madame Anjou's, the stove crackled away merrily, with the flues ringing and roaring. One of the cadets was standing guard by the exit, never taking his eyes off the motorcycle standing just outside in the street, while five cadets slept the sleep of the dead, having spread their greatcoats out on the floor of the shop. By 1 o'clock, the colonel had finally been able to settle down at Madame Anjou's. Even then, however, he did not go to bed, but was constantly on the telephone, yawning all the time. And then, at 2 o'clock in the morning, a motorcycle roared up to the shop, and a military man in a grey coat climbed out. "Let him through. It's for me," the colonel said. The man handed the colonel a bulky package wrapped in a sheet and tied both ways with string. The colonel personally placed it in the little safe at the end of the shop and locked it with a padlock. The man in the greatcoat sped off on his motorbike, while the colonel went up to the gallery, where, spreading his coat out on the floor and placing under his head a pile of rags, he lay down. After ordering the cadet on duty to wake him at exactly 6:30, he fell asleep.